escape the pressures of the capital there. Zai nodded. He must know of her condition. The mad senator the Greys called her, a woman driven insane by crowds and cities, yet who made politics her profession. The man swallowed before he spoke. I would like to see that, Senator. Then come with me there tomorrow, Lieutenant Commander. He raised his glass. To a glorious wasteland. A truly grey place, she answered. 2. Rescue attempt. No plan survives contact with the enemy. Anonymous 81. Senator. She woke without sanity. The temporal ice released her quickly. Its lattice of tiny, interwoven stasis fields unraveled, and time rushed back into her body like water through a suddenly crumbling dam, inundating a valley long denied it. Her mind became aware, emerging as it always did from cold sleep, raw and unprotected from the raging mindstorm of the city. She awoke to madness. Here, in these exposed moments, the capital screamed in her brain. Its billions of minds roared, seethed, shrieked like a host of seagulls tearing at the carcass of some giant creature exposed upon a beach, fighting amongst themselves as they rendered their huge find. Even in her madness, though, she knew the source of the psychic screaming. The rotting creature was empire. The vast chorus of keening voices was all the myriad struggles for power and prestige that animated the imperial capital. The noise of these contests thundered through her, for a moment obliterating any sense of self, her identity a lone mountaineer engulfed by an avalanche. Then she heard her apathy bracelet begin its injection sequence, the reassuring hiss audible even through the deluge of sound. Then her empathic abilities began to fade under the drug's influence. The voices grew dim, and a sense of self returned. The woman remembered who she was, childhood names spilling through her mind. Nareya, Naya, Nana, and then the titles of adulthood, Dr. Nara Oxum, Electate Oxum of the Vasthold Assembly, Her Excellency Nara Oxum, representative to His Majesty's government from the planet Vasthold, Senator Nara Oxum, Secularist Party Whip, popularly known as the Mad Senator. As the psychic howl receded, Oxum steeled herself and concentrated on the city, listening carefully for tone and character as it trailed away. Here on home, she was always threatened by the crush of voices, the wild psychic noise that had kept her in an asylum for most of her childhood years. But sometimes, as the apathy drug entered her veins, in this passing moment between madness and sanity, Nara could make sense of it, could catch a few notes of the multiplex and chaotic music that the capital played. It was a useful ability for a politician. The sound of the risen empire's politics was troubled today, she heard. Something was coalescing, like an orchestra tuning itself to a single note. She tried to focus, to bring her mind to bear on the theme of unease. But then her empathy faded, extinguished by the drug. Her insanity was, for the moment, cured, and she was deaf to the city's cry. Senator Nara Oxum took a deep breath, flexed her awakening muscles. She sat up on the cold sleep bed and opened her eyes. Morning. The sky was salmon and the sun orange through the penthouse's bubble, the facets of the distant diamond palace tinged with blood. The bubble silenced the capital, the transparent woven carbon barely trembling for passing helicopters. But the city still buzzed, flickers of movement and the winking lights of signage shimmering in her vision, distant air cars blurring the air like gnats or heat haze on a desert. In the odd way of cold sleep, her eyes felt clean, as if she had only closed them for a moment. A moment that had lasted. The date was displayed on the bedroom's large wall screen. Since she had entered cold sleep, 3 of Homeworld's short months had passed. That was puzzling and alarming. Usually, the senatorial stasis breaks lasted half a year. Something important was happening then. The disquieting sound Oxum had heard on the Lyman of Madness returned to her. She called up the status of her colleagues. Most were already animated, the rest were coming up as she watched. The full Senate was being awakened for a special session. As Senator Nara Oxum crossed the Rubicon Pale at the bottom of the forum steps, the reassuring wash of politics surrounded her, drowning out the shapeless anxiety she had felt coming out of cold sleep. In one corner of her hearing, she now registered the drone of the inherited intellectual property filibuster. The filibuster in its 87th decade was as calming and timeless, and as meaningless, Senator Oxum supposed, as the roar of a distant ocean. Farther away in the echoey space of secondary audio, she sensed plodding committee meetings, strident media conferences, the self-righteous energy of a loyalty party caucus meeting. And, of course, easily discernible by its sovereign resonance, the debate in the great forum itself. She blinked, and a lower third informed her that Senator Purim Drexler had the floor. A tiny corner of her synesthetic sight showed his face, the familiar milky grey eyes and elaborate liquid rolls of flesh that poured from his cheekbones. President of the Senate, a figurehead position, Drexler was said to be over 250 years old, not counting cryo and, in his own relativistic framework, not imperial absolute. But his exquisitely weathered face had never seemed quite real to her. On Fatawa, which he represented in the Senate, the surgical affectation of age was almost as fashionable as that of youth. The ancient Solon cleared his throat languorously, the dry sound as gritty and sharp as a handful of small gravel poured slowly onto glass. As she climbed the forum steps, Senator Oxum brought the fingertips of her left hand together, which signaled her handlers to pick her up. The other voices in the Senate infrastructure muted as her chief of staff confirmed the day's itinerary with her. "Where's Roger?" Oxum asked after her schedule was confirmed. The morning scheduling ritual usually belonged to Roger Niles, her consultant extraordinary. The absence of his familiar voice disturbed Oxum, brought back her earlier uneasiness. "He's deep, Senator," her chief of staff answered. "He's been in an analysis fugue all morning, but he leaked a request that you see him face to face at your earliest convenience." The morning's disquiet flooded back in now. Niles was a very reserved creature. A meeting at his own insistence would mean serious news. "I see," Oxum said flatly. She wondered what the old consultant had discovered. "Bring my synesthesia to full bandwidth." At her command, data swelled before Oxum in secondary and tertiary sight and hearing, blossoming into the familiar maelstrom of her personal configuration. Nameplates, color-coded by party affiliation and striped with recent votes, hovered about the other senators flowing up the steps. Real-time polygraph poll reactions of wired political junkies writhed at the edge of vision, forming hurricane whirls that shifted with every procedural vote. The latest headcounts of her party's whip AI invoked tones at the threshold of hearing, soft and consonant chords for measures sure to pass, harsh, dissonant intervals for bills that were losing support. Nara Oxum breathed in this clamour like a seagoing passenger emerging onto deck for air. This moment, at the edge of power before one dived in and lost oneself, restored her confidence. The bracing rush of politics gave Nara what others were given by mountain climbing or incipient violence or the pleasure of a first cigarette before dressing. The senator smiled as she headed for her offices. Nara Oxum often wondered how politics had been possible before second sight. Without induced synesthesia, the intrusion of sight into the other brain centers, how did a human mind absorb the necessary data? She could imagine going without synesthesia in certain activities, flying an aircraft, day trading, surgery, where one could focus on a single image, but not in politics. Non-interfering layers of sight, the ability to fill three visual and two auditory fields with data, were a perfect metaphor for politics itself. The checks and balances, the competing constituencies, the layers of power, money, and rhetoric. Even though the medical procedure that made it possible caused odd mental results in 1 in 10,000 recipients, Oxum's own empathy was such a reaction, she couldn't imagine the political world, gloriously multi-track and torrid, without it. She'd tried the old pre-synesthesia eye screens that covered up normal vision, but they'd brought on a claustrophobic panic. Who would trust the Senate to a blinkered horse? The disquiet she had felt all morning tugged at Nara again. The feeling was familiar, but vaguely so, in the way of old smells and déjà vu. She tried to place it, comparing the sensation to her anxieties before elections, important Senate votes, or large parties thrown in her honor. Nara Oxum recalled those apprehensions easily. She lived her life fighting them, weathering them, indulging in them. She was old friends with anxiety, that poor sister of madness which the drugs never fully vanquished. But the current feeling was too slippery. She couldn't find the worry that had started it. She checked her wrist, where the dermal injector blinked happily green. It couldn't be an empathy flare. The drugs made sure of that, but it certainly felt like one. When she reached her offices, she strode past supplicant aides and a few hopeful lobbyists, heading straight for Roger Niles's dark lair at the center of her domain. No one dared follow her. His office doors opened without a word, and she walked through, removed a stack of laundered shirts from his guest chair, and sat down. "I'm here," she said. She kept her voice calm, knowing his interface AI would bring him up from the data fugue if she sounded impatient. Better to let him cross back into the real world at his own pace. His face had the slack look of deep fugue, but his eyebrows lifted in response to her words, sending ripples up his high expanse of forehead. One finger on his right hand twitched. He looked too small for his desk, a circular monstrosity of dark wood that enclosed Niles like some giant life-support machine. Senator Oxum had recently discovered that its copious drawers and pigeonholes held only clothes, shoes, and a few emergency rations extorted from military lobbyists. Roger Niles thought the habit of going home at night to be an inexcusable weakness. "Something bad, isn't it?" she asked. The finger twitched again. Niles looked older. Senator Oxum had only been in stasis for 3 months, but in that short absence a frosting of grey had touched his temples. Her staff had the right to go into cryo during the breaks, but Niles seldom did, preferring to work out the true decades of her term, aging before her eyes. The loneliness of the senator, Oxum thought. The world moved so quickly past. Senators were elected for, or appointed to, competed for, bought, whatever their planet's custom, 50-year terms, half an imperial absolute century of office. The risen empire was a slowly evolving beast. Even here in the dense cored clusters, 80 populated worlds was an area 30 light years across, and the exigencies of war, trade, and migration were bound by the appallingly slow rate of light speed. The Imperial Senate was constituted to take the long view. The Solans generally spent 80% of their terms in stasis sleep as the universe wheeled by. They made decisions with the detachment of mountains, watching rivers below shift course. Unavoidably, the planet that Oxum represented had changed in her first decade in office, and the trip to home from Vasthold had consumed 5 absolute years. When she returned, 60 years total would have passed, all her friends infirm or dead, her 3 nephews well into middle age. Even Niles was aging before her eyes. The Senate demanded much from its members. But the time thief couldn't steal everyone. Oxum had found someone new, a lover who was a starship captain, a fellow victim of time dilation. Though the man was gone now, absolute years away in the Spinwood reaches, Oxum had begun to match her stasis sleeps to his relativistic framework. The universe was slipping past them both at almost the same rate. When he came back, they would share the same year's passage. Senator Oxum leaned back into her chair and listened with half her mind to the flow of political data in her secondary senses. But it was pointless to do anything except wait for Niles. As political animals went, Senator Oxum was fundamentally unlike her chief of staff. She was a holist, feeling the Senate as an organism, an animal whose actions could be tamed or at least understood. Niles, at the other extreme, lived by the dictum that all politics is local. His gods were in the details. The office was crowded with hardware that kept him linked to the everyday goings-on of each of the 80 worlds. Ration riots on Miasm, religious bombings on Veridani, the daily offensives and retaliations of 1,000 price wars, ethnic struggles and media trials, all maintained in real time by quantum entangled communications. Senatorial privilege allowed him to monitor the internal workings of news agencies, financial consortia, even the private missives of those wealthy enough to send translite data. And Miles could put it all together in his magnificent brain. Senator Oxum knew her colleagues as individuals and could feel the hard edges of their petty vanities and obsessions, but Roger Niles saw senators as composite creatures of data, walking clearinghouses for the host of agendas and pressures from their home worlds. The two sat across from each other in silence for a few more minutes. Niles's finger twitched again. Nara sat back, knowing that this could take a while. It was dark in the room. The crystalline columns of the comm hardware loomed like insect cities made of glass. Perhaps fireflies, the senator thought. The crystals were pinpoint dappled by sunlight filtered through tiny holes in a smart polymer curtain that extended across the glass ceiling. Oxum looked upward with an annoyed expression, and the millimeter-wide holes responded, dilating a bit. Now she could feel the sun on her hands, which she splayed palm down, relishing the cool metal of Niles's desk. In the patterned light, her chief of staff's face seemed tattooed with a fine trompe-l'œil veil. He opened his eyes. "War," he said. The word sent ice down Senator Nara Oxum's spine. I'm seeing Imperial tax relief throughout the Spinwood world, Niles said, tapping the right side of his head as if his brain were a map of the Empire. Every system within 4 light years of the Rix frontier is having its economy stimulated, courtesy of the Risen One. And the Lackey Party caucus has buried parallel measures in that maintenance bill they've been debating all morning. Is that war or just patronage as usual? Oxum asked dubiously. The Risen Emperor and the Senate levied taxes separately, their sources of revenue as carefully delineated as the Rubicon Pale around the Forum building. But however separate Crown and government were meant to be, the Loyalty Party, true to its name, always followed the Emperor's lead, especially when it helped the voters back home. Loyalty was traditionally strong in the Spinwood Reaches, as it was in every outskirt region where other cultures loomed threateningly close. Normally I'd say it was the usual alms for the faithful, Niles answered. But the Corwood and outward loyalist regions aren't sharing in the largesse. On the contrary, those ends of the Empire are taking a big hit. Over the last 12 hours, I'm seeing higher honoraria tributes, skyrocketing futures on titles and pardons, even 100-year imperial loans being called. The money isn't earmarked yet, but only the military could spend amounts like this. So the Navy's being strengthened, and the Spinwood Reaches fattened up? Oxum said. It sounded like war with the Rix. Riches to fund military forces and comfort for the regions threatened by reprisal. The Chief of Staff cocked his head as if someone were whispering in his ear. Labour futures on Fatawa tightened by 3 points this morning. 3! Probably reservists being called up. No one left to sweep the floors. Oxum shook her head at the Risen Emperor's madness. It had been 80 years since the Rix incursion. Why provoke them now? Though not numerous, the Rix were unspeakably dangerous. The strange technologies bestowed on them by their AI gods made them the deadliest combatants the Empire had ever faced. Moreover, war with them was always a less than zero-sum game. They owned very little worth taking, having no real planets of their own. They seeded compound mines and moved on. They were spores for the planetary beings they worshipped, more a cult than a culture. But when injured, they made sure to injure in return. Why would the Risen Empire want another war with the Rix? She wondered aloud. Any evidence of a recent attack? Oxum silently cursed the secrecy of the Imperial State, which rarely allowed the senatorial government detailed military intelligence. What was going on out there in that distant blackness? She shivered for a moment, thinking of one man in particular who would be in harm's way. She pushed the thought aside. As I said, this has all been in the last few hours, Niles said. I don't have raw data from the frontier for that time frame. Either precipitated by an emergency or the Imperials have hidden their plans, Senator Oxum said. Well, they've blown their cover now, Niles finished. Oxum interleaved her fingers, her hand making a double fist. The gesture triggered a sudden and absolute silence in her head, shutting off the din of orating Solons, the clamor of messages and amendments, the pulse of polls and constituent chatter. War, she thought. The galling domain of tyrants, the sport of gods and would-be gods, and most distressingly, the profession of her newest lover. The Risen One had better have a damn good reason for this. Senator Oxum leaned back and glared into Roger Niles's eyes. She allowed her mind to start planning, to sort through the precisely defined powers of the Senate for the fulcra that could impede the Emperor's course. And as she felt the cold surety of political power flowing into her, her anxieties retreated. Our Risen Father may not want our advice and consent, she said, but let's see if we can't get his attention. Captain. For the first 12 years of his life, Lawrence Zai had been, embarrassingly, the tallest of his schoolmates. Not strongest, not quickest. Just a lofty, clumsy boy in a society that valued compact, graceful bodies. Since long before Laurent was born, Vader had elected and re-elected as its governor a short, solid woman who stood with arms crossed and feet far apart, a symbol of stability. As young as 7 standard, Laurent began to pray to the Risen Emperor that he would stop growing, but his journey toward the sky continued relentlessly. By age 11, it was too late merely to cease getting taller. He had already passed the average height for Vaden adults. He asked the Risen Deity to shrink him, but his biology mentor AI explained that growing shorter was scientifically unlikely, at least for the next 60 years or so. And on Vader, one did not pray to the Risen Emperor to change the laws of nature, which were his laws after all. Ever logical, Lawrence Zai implored the Emperor to effect the only remaining solution. Increased height among his schoolmates, a burst of growth among his peers, or a demographic shift that would rescue Laurent from his outcast status. In the summer term that year, transfer students from low-gravity Krupp Reich flooded Laurent Zai's school. These were refugees displaced by the ravages of the new German flu. The towering Reichers were gawky, easily fatigued, and thickly accented. These survivors were immune to the flu and had, of course, been decontaminated, fleeing the societal meltdown of population collapse rather than the virus itself. But the stench of contagion still clung to them, and they were so disgracefully tall. Zai was their worst tormentor. He mastered the art of tripping the Rikers from behind as they walked, nudging a trailing foot so that it hooked the other ankle with their next step. He graffitied the margins of chapel prayer books with clumsy stick figures as tall as a page. Laurent was not alone in his misbehavior. The Rikers were so mistreated that a month after their arrival, the entire student body was assembled around the soccer field air screen. In the giant viewing area, over the field upon which Laurent had been so often humiliated by shorter, quicker footballers, images from the Krupp Reich pandemic were shown. It was pure propaganda, an art for which Badens were justly famous, a way to shame the native children into ceasing their torments of the newcomers. The victims were carefully aestheticized, shown dying under white gauze to hide the pulsing red sores of the new German flu. Photos from pre-flu family reunions were altered to reflect the disease's progress, the victims fading into sepia one by one, until only a few smiling survivors remained, their arms around ghostly relatives. The final image in the presentation was the huge monolithic Reich Square in Bonnberg, time-lapsed through successive Sunday afternoons over the last 4 years. The population of tourists, hawkers, merchants, and strollers on the square dwindled slowly, then seemed to stabilize, then crashed relentlessly. Finally, a lone figure scuttled across the great sheet of copper. Although only a few picture elements tall, the figure seemed to be rushing fearfully, as if wary of some flying predator overhead. 12-year-old Laurent Zai sat with his jaw slack amidst the overwhelming silence peculiar to shamed children, thinking the same words again and again. What have I done? When the air screen faded, Zai bolted down the stairs, shaking off the restraining hand of an annoyed proctor. He fled to sanctuary under the bleachers and fell to his knees in the litter of spectator trash. His hands together in the clasp of prayer, he started to ask for forgiveness. He hadn't asked the Emperor for this. How could he have known that the Reich pandemic would be the result of his request for taller classmates? With his praying lips almost against the ground, the stench of cigarette butts and old honey wine bottles and rotten fruit under the bleachers struck him like a blow to the stomach. He vomited profusely into his prayer-locked hands in an acid stream that burned like whiskey in his mouth and nose. His hands remained faintly sticky and smelled of vomit the rest of that day, no matter how furiously he washed them. As if some switch deep within him had been permanently thrown, the position of prayer always brought back a glimmer of that intense moment of shame and nausea. The murmurs of morning chapel seemed to coalesce into an acid trickle down the back of his throat. The airscreen rallies in which the risen emperor's visage slowly turned over an ululating crowd filled his stomach with bile. Laurent Zai had never prayed to the risen emperor again. He never drank, for every toast on Vader asked the risen deity for luck and health. And even as Cadet Zai waited for word of admission into the Imperial Naval Academy, he lay silent in the endless minutes before sleep every night, recalling every misstep and victory in his 6-week application trial. But not praying. 30 subjective years later, however, seated in the shipmaster's chair of His Majesty's frigate Lynx, Captain Laurent Zai took a moment to pare his hands over nose and mouth. He still smelled the bile of that long-ago shame. "Make this work," he demanded in a harsh whisper. "As for me, I want to return to my beloved. As for her, she's your damned sister." The bitter prayer ended. Zai brought his hands down and opened his eyes. "Launch," he commanded. Executive officer. XO Kathry Hobbs noted from her status board that the entry vehicle carrying the apparatus initiate Barris had not been fully gelled. The safety AI began to protest the dangers posed by an incompletely prepped insertion vehicle. Hobbs smiled grimly, cancelling the safety overrides, and the order went through. "Operation is launched, sir." Almost simultaneously, four specially reconfigured turret blisters along the underside of the links each fired one railgun and one plasma burst, a pair of each type of projectile headed toward four carefully plotted targets below. The plasma bursts bolted ahead at 20% light speed, their 12,000-degree core temperatures burning a tunnel of vacuum through the atmosphere. Their burn length perfectly timed, they scattered into gouts of flame upon impact, leaving as their only marks four smooth concave hemispheres burned into the palace's stone walls. The railgun projectiles followed in their wake. Compound Mind. The attack was registered by the warning system erected by the Rick's compound mind still propagating across the planet's data and communication systems. The plasma bolts left a long, bellicose streak behind them, clearly originating from the point Alexander had already predicted that an Imperial warship would station itself to attempt a rescue. The mind required less than 2 milliseconds to determine that such an attempt was underway and to order that the hostages be killed. However, the Rick's commandos were not data-linked to the still-propagating mind. Alexander was a composite of Imperial technology, after all, which was incompatible with Rick's communications. Alexander was forced to relay its order through a transponder sitting in the center of the table in the council chamber. The transponder received the compound mind's signal and immediately let out a loud squawk, a dense static whose crenellations were coded like some ancient audio modem. The squawk began its journey from the transponder outward toward the Rick's commandos at the speed of sound. The nearest commando was 4 meters away and the sound would reach her in roughly 8 milliseconds, 1/100 of a second after the attack had begun. Racing against this warning were the 4 structured smart alloy slugs launched from the Lynx's railguns. These projectiles, massing less than a few centigrams, barreled at 10% light speed through the near vacuum cylinders burned for them by the plasma bolts, flying straight as lasers. They traversed the distance to the palace in far less time than it took for Legius's atmospheric pressure to slam closed their vacuum paths. They reached the plasma-smooth hemispheres of their entry points into the palace within 7 milliseconds. The slugs were cylinders no wider than a human hair follicle. They sliced through the ancient palace walls, releasing a carefully calculated fraction of their awesome kinetic energy. The stone around the entry points ribbed with sudden webs of cracks, like safety glass struck with a hammer. The impact altered the slugs, transforming them into their second programmed shape, a larger spheroid that flattened on impact, breaking the projectiles as they slammed through the floors and walls of the palace. In the seconds after their passage, the old palace would boom and shake, whole walls exploding into dust. Localized but terrific windstorms would soon rise up as the air inside the palace was set in motion by the slugs' passage. After the 7th such collision, a number calculated by the Lynx's AI using precise models of the palace's architecture, the slugs ballooned to their largest size. The smart alloy stretched into a mesh of hexagons, expanding outward like a child's paper snowflake and attaining the surface area of a large coin. These much-slowed slugs struck their targets, hitting the Rick's commandos while the warning squawk from the transponder was just under a meter away, 0.008 of a second after the attack had begun. The slugs tore through the commandos' chests, leaving tunnels that were momentarily as exact as holes drilled in metal. But then the wake of the slug's passage pulled a pulverized spray of blood, tissue, and biomechanical enhancements through the exit wounds, filling the council chamber with a maelstrom of ichor. The 4 commandos tumbled to the ground, their bones shattered and implants liquefacted by the blow. For the moment, the hostages were safe. Doctor. Above, the Marines were on their way. 25 entry vehicles accelerated down launch tubes riding electromagnetic rails at absurd velocities. 37 Gs hit Dr. Vetcher like a brain hemorrhage, shifting the color behind his closed eyes from red to pink to the white of the hottest flame. A roar filled his gel-sealed ears, and he felt his body malform, squashed down into the floor of his vehicle under a giant's foot. If not for his yoke of gel and the injected and inhaled smart polymers that marbled his body tissue, he would have died in several instantaneous and exotic ways. As it was, it hurt like hell. The entry vehicles hit the dense air of the mesopause almost instantly and spun a precise 180 degrees to orient their passengers' feet down, firing retro rockets to begin braking and targeting. They spread out, screaming meteors surging across the day-lit sky of Legius 15. Only 3 were targeted near the council chamber. Each vehicle that landed close to the hostages carried the risk of injuring the child empress. The Marines would be spread out, deployed to sweep for the three remaining Rick's commandos and secure the now twice battered palace. Dr. Vetcher's entry vehicle was fractionally ahead of the others and was aimed closest to the council chamber. It burst through the palace's three sets of outer walls, the impacts shaking.